Okay, so the background for this psalm, which is one of... Does anybody know how many penitent psalms there are? What is a penitent psalm?
Sorry for sin.
Right, begging for forgiveness, sorry for sin. Yes, okay. There are seven, two of which are not attributed to David. Actually, a third one is not attributed to David, but I think he wrote it because of the wording. And, you know, most of them say something about his bones melting or his bones hurting, that kind of thing. So the language is the same. But anyway, this particular psalm has a little title up here that tells us what he's talking about, the specific incident in his life that he is penitent for at this time. So the background for that is in 2 Samuel 11 and 12. So I guess we should turn over there first, because I do want to talk about that a little bit. So what actions or non-actions brought David to sin? I mean, what led up to his actual sin?
Well, he didn't go to battle with his men.
Right, and what's unusual about that?
I guess usually he should be there.
Well, the verse actually said, as kings do.
Yeah.
So that was kind of unusual, I think. He wasn't where he belonged. He wasn't where he was supposed to be. Okay, what else?
Then he was up walking on the roof, and then he saw Bathsheba. And I had never noticed this before. I read the way the houses were built. It's like a courtyard that was enclosed, and she was actually in her house when he saw her.
But it was open to the sky.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. Yeah. He was probably at a higher level, is the way I've always pictured it, where he could just look out. Is there anything wrong with him walking on his roof?
No.
Nope. And I'm not sure if there's anything wrong with her bathing on a rooftop. I don't know where the normal bathing place was. I really don't know. But what was wrong? What did he do wrong?
Lusted.
Right. He didn't turn away.
He didn't flee.
He didn't flee like Joseph did, and like we're commanded to in the New Testament. Okay, so then, of course, he went right ahead and called her in, which any other man probably couldn't have just done that. Just get that woman for me. Because he was king, he took advantage of his position, committed adultery, then what?
Well, he knew that she was married in the first place. I mean,
he asked who she was.
Even after he looked and saw and wanted her, when he found out that she was Uriah's wife, that should have
right. If he couldn't get himself away with his own power. Right.
Right.
But didn't. No.
But he knew, and so he sent for her.
Right. And would she have come if anybody else had sent for her? Any other man? No, she probably didn't have a whole lot of choice because he was the king. She probably, I don't know that she knew what he wanted. Who knows? You know, hopefully she wasn't up there trying to attract men. I don't know. We don't really have much insight into as to her character and what she was like.
We can fall in the same trap. We know how bad David was. But we can know something is wrong. But we
walk right into it.
Or we blinded ourselves to the fact that we're above it and
do it anyway. Doesn't apply to me, or God wants me to be happy, the old refrain. All right, so once he'd committed adultery, what happens?
Tried to cover up his sins.
He tried to cover up. She got pregnant, so it couldn't be hidden anymore. I mean, it couldn't be unknown what he was doing, which obviously the fact that he got caught and had to do something to protect her reputation, I assume, and I guess his. So he calls Uriah home and hoping he can, you know, he'll sleep with his wife and then everybody will think it's Uriah's baby. That's pretty low. Huh?
He was cunning.
Very. I think that's really low. I think that's just creepy. But anyway, he did it. And of course, Uriah was a man with principles. He didn't think it was right to sleep with his wife in the comfort of his wife's bed while his men were in battle. He just slept outside on the floor, or outside the door, or outside the house, or something. And so that failed. So David did what?
And
arranged for his murder.
And not only involved himself, he involved Joab.
Exactly. And Joab wasn't real crazy about this idea, was he? It bothered him. I have a note about that somewhere. Well, I guess we'll come to it. I'm not going to try to do like I did last time and try to keep finding myself and then getting lost. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So he arranges to have Uriah put in the front of battle. Uriah follows orders. He gets killed. Joab follows orders. So he's guilty of some sin here. Thank you, David. And how does James 1, 14 and 15 describe the process of sin? Is that familiar to anybody?
It's gone away from our own lust. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't blame God. We can't really, you know, blame Satan. It's, you know, the devil didn't make you do it. But, and right. It's...
can't blame that other person.
It's temptation, our lust is temptation, and then it's
right. It's a step-by-step process, isn't it? That's what struck me about this particular passage. When you are tempted and drawn away by our own desires and enticed, which is what, where's the verse that talks about the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh and the pride of life? So, where's that? Okay, 1 John, where that describes what sin is or how sin gets started. So, this verse even is, he's tempted, he sees it, or he wants it, or he doesn't want to be... or he needs it to assuage his pride or whatever. So he's tempted by it and drawn by it instead of walking away from it. Like we have Bible examples of people who did walk away from it, who had opportunities and refused to take them because they didn't want to dishonor their God. Okay, and then here, after you're drawn away, desire conceives and it gives birth to sin. You know, so if you don't get yourself away from it, if you don't get off that back on the straight path, then you're in sin. And then if that is not taken care of, what's the final result?
Death.
Does that mean we die when we sin? No, physically? It's separation from God. We no longer have that connection to God that is so important for us, both for salvation, for our day-to-day, you know, comfort and peace and our example for others. We cannot be an example to other people if we don't have a connection with God that people can see, that we have no influence and we have no... We can't even be an encouragement if we're a discouragement. Okay? In chapter 11, before we leave 2 Samuel, chapter 11, verse 27, said that what David did displeased the Lord. All the versions I found said that except the New American Standard, which said this was evil in the sight of the Lord. That's quite a bit stronger than displeased the Lord. I guess what displeases the Lord is evil anyway, but... either way, it's bad. He took a whole bunch of steps that just led him further and further into the hole, basically. Anybody else have any comments, or anybody have any comments on number one? All right, let's go back over to Psalms 51. And actually, before we do, we're going to talk about what we can do to avoid finding ourselves in David's particular spot. Sandra.
I came across something that really was interesting and brought back to life in Matthew 26:31. Jesus was talking to his disciples, and he said, all of you will be made to stumble. In verse 33, Peter said, I will never be made to stumble. And then in verse 35, Peter said, I will not deny you. So said all the disciples. They all were just, it's not going to happen to me. And then in verse 57, we read, all the disciples forsook him and fled.
Okay. What do you think, what are those, the three things that caused sin, do you think that is, that caused them to run away? In Peter's case, to outright deny Jesus.
You mean like lust of flesh?
Fear, which would be, I would think, the pride of life. They're afraid for their lives. Because they see Jesus taken and they're thinking, man, if they're going to take him, then they're going to take anybody connected to him. Because he's the center.
I forgot to say, in the middle of all that, in verse 41, Jesus was talking to them about what they kept falling asleep. And he was trying to tell them to watch and pray.
So okay, that's excellent. That's an excellent answer to what can I do to avoid similar situations. We can watch and pray. We can be on the alert, which we've all heard many, many times in this pulpit, probably elsewhere as well. If we're not on the alert, what can happen? If we're not watchful,
that's when the devil,
yeah, we got. He's right there beside us, wanting to.
First Peter 5. 5:8-9 talks about being a sober spirit and being on the alert, you know, and resist the devil.
Okay. Okay. This involves literally turning my eyes away from things I shouldn't see. Correct. So what form might that be in? Obviously, you can't miss it sometimes walking down the street. But what can we control ourselves to keep our eyes from seeing?
Yeah.
turn off the television, things like that.
Don't go to the movies. Where else might we go that we would be seeing things we might not should?
Well, I hope we would not be in some of the saloons and the dives.
Yeah.
You know, and the parties.
I hope not.
Some of the parties and things like that.
I was thinking of places like where people undress. You know, like,
Schlitterbahn.
It is not easy to tell your kids, no, you can't go there. And I don't know, maybe, I mean, if they're really small, I guess it's not going to be a big deal. They're not going to notice anything. But when they're teenagers, they're noticing.
When they're little, they're sure going to want to go.
Right, it's hard to cut it off somewhere. Where do you pick the age? So another thing is, something else that David did eventually, which we're going to talk about later. When he faced the truth, when he finally admitted that he was wrong, who did he blame?
Himself.
He blamed himself. He took the blame. He put it where it belongs. He didn't try to say, but they made me do it, or I can't help it. Her dress is too short. You know, that kind of thing. And another thing, besides keeping our eyes away from things, we can avoid situations where temptation might be. What about dating? And I could say young people, but older people date too. Sometimes, you know, when they don't have a mate, they're going to date. And it's probably easier for older people because easier to fall into temptation because especially if they've been married, you know, what should you avoid there? Well, did y'all allow your kids to have people of the opposite sex in their home when you weren't there when they were teenagers? I didn't. That was a no-no. That was a big no-no. I didn't want that. I didn't want my kids to. I didn't know if they were old enough or strong enough to face that temptation or not. But why should I put them there? I'm their parent. I need to be making sure they don't get in that situation. That doesn't mean they don't get under the radar sometimes. But we need to teach our kids and our grandkids that if you're voluntarily going somewhere where you know there could be a problem. And generally, you have to lie to somebody to do it if you're young. You have to hide something. People are, you know, that's something that people want to hide, basically, when they're spending time together and they're alone when they shouldn't be and, you know, things get out of control. So.
That's what I mean. One of the things I put down is keeping my conscience clear and clean and not let it be seared. You know, 1 Timothy 4 speaks of that. Mm-hmm. And because if we go against our conscience long enough, then our heart can't be pricked.
Right.
And so we have to be careful.
You ruin your conscience, don't you?
Really keep my conscience, you know.
Mm-hmm. What did David fail to do in the matter of Uriah that we should always think to do?
He didn't love him.
He did not love him. He did not put him above himself. He just looked at him as somebody in the way. He was disposable. I believe, didn't it say somewhere she mourned her husband?
Well, I mean, that kind of love.
Caring love. I know. If he cared about her, he would never have put her in that position.
He would have never called for her if he cared for her.
Yeah.
I mean, she was married.
Good point. So if we are putting our needs above everybody else's needs, then we're not, first of all, we're not following the example of Jesus, who, you know, put everybody above himself. He subjugated himself completely. He gave his life for us because he loved us. And when we care about other people, we're not going to do things that hurt them.
So many times it's not a need, really. David didn't have a need for Bathsheba. He had lives. If he had desires, he had a place to fulfill it. It's usually a need.
Right. It's a want, not a need. Absolutely. All right. Anything else anybody wants to say on number two?
Well, you know, we were talking about fleeing, and the opposite of that is it's like the fruits of the spirit versus the fruits, the rest of the flesh. But in fleeing, Paul told Timothy to flee youthful lust, but he gave him something to pursue, and that's another thing. If you teach your children to pursue, in 1 Timothy 2. Righteousness and faith and love, and from a pure heart, it's going to keep the devil, hopefully, at bay.
Right.
It's going to give you more armor you know, to keep those lusts from penetrating and giving in to them.
That's right. If we put our focus on spiritual and godly things rather than fleshly things, that would be even easier to pursue godly and righteous things in righteousness and flee the sin.
Yeah, if David had a thought just one moment about righteousness of God and, you know, and what was right, he would...
And at this point, what had God done for him? A few things. Just a few. All right, now let's go to Psalm 51:1. And what did David ask for in verse 1?
Mercy.
Please have mercy on me. And also, loving kindness is sometimes... Does New American Standard say mercy in the first phrase and loving kindness in the second? Yeah.
Be gracious to me.
Okay, because I wrote down grace as well. Be gracious to me according to your mercy or according to your loving kindness?
Loving kindness.
Okay. All right. Pretty much interchangeable words. Nothing he deserved. He certainly didn't deserve it. He deserved, punishment, which he did get in several forms. But he's asking him to have mercy because he has transgressions that need to be blotted out at the end of the verse. So he's admitting his sin. He's asking God to remove them for him. In chapter 32 of this book, Psalm 32, which is, I don't know if it's in the superscription, but I think it's generally assumed to be about this same incident. Is there proof for that? Anybody know? It's another penitential psalm. But in verse 3, when I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you. My iniquity I have not hidden. I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. So similar language to over here where he is admitting that he sinned. He's admitting that he did wrong and that he's suffering as well, which he mentions... verse 8, make me hear joy and gladness that the bones you have broken may rejoice. And he's, in verse 3 and 4, he's talking about his sin is always before him. You know, when we do something of this magnitude, we mess up this bad, it can affect you if you have any conscience left at all. It can affect you physically, emotionally, mentally. I mean, it really has a huge impact on a person. It doesn't if they've seared their heart, like Linda said. What happens? They just keep going, getting worse and worse and worse. You know, like, I mean, the first thing that comes to my head is the mob. You know, if they don't get things done right, they just kill that person or knock them off. And without any conscience at all about, or any concern that they've taken a person's life.
Mob.
Oh, yeah. The mob is... or some other psychopath that doesn't have any feelings at all for other people, that has no empathy. Unfortunately, some people are born that way. I don't even know why. I think they are. I don't know if they can be fixed or not. I'm not a psychiatrist. But God says if we want to do what's right, then we can make a change, correct? All right. So, obviously, there's nobody in the mob here. But
if somebody can't change, God can't hold them responsible.
That's true.
It's something they cannot do anything about. The way I took your question is I just summed up the whole verse, and to me, the first verse is begging for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. There's certain words in there, but when you ask, what did he ask for? To me, what he's asking for in the first verse is forgiveness.
Right, well, yeah, but he to get that, it's got to be through mercy and grace, because he sure isn't going to earn it.
Oh, I agree with that. No, I agree with that. It was just, but that's what he's asking for. Be gracious. Draw out my transgressions. And so he realizes he needs that. And sometimes it takes people forever to get to that point to see that they have.
If they ever do.
Yeah, some people never do. But if they do, then it's...
we're real good at deceiving ourselves, aren't we?
That's one of Satan's most powerful
things,
I think.
That's so true. Okay, so what? Then as he starts to confess his sin that he's asking for forgiveness for, what are the three words he uses to describe his wrongdoing? Yes. Okay, how did y'all define these? Let's start with transgression.
Mm-hmm.
violation of law for the end of the meeting.
Right. It literally means to go across.
I even found rebellious revolt.
Okay.
Kind of
rebellion. Okay. Another Vine's description was go aside or beyond, overstepping, and another place it's, I saw off the path. So, in other words, and I also wrote down lawlessness because that's literally said in the New Testament. That, or actually, it says sin is a transgression of the law, or lawlessness. It's translated both ways. So that is basically going around or across or against the law. Okay? Rebellion against the law. What about iniquity? What did y'all put there?
One thing I had was gross injustice. That pretty well describes the situation.
Yes, all around. All around. He even hurt himself. All right, what, anybody else?
I have deviation from what is right, wickedness, guilt worthy of punishment.
Right. It literally means twisted or crooked. Deviate from something. And so another, and some synonyms would be unrighteousness, lawlessness, and wickedness. So all of that covers it really well. And then sin, what does that actually mean?
Failure's defined as depravity. When you think of something like, when we think of totally depraved in the Calvinism, and they're described as there's just no hope for them. You know, they have to have a calling and all that. But I mean, when you think of somebody that's just depraved, you think, man, that's bad.
Really, really wicked. But really, if you think about twisted or crooked, that's exactly what depraved means. There's something wrong. There's something off. They've gotten so far away from what's right that, I mean, it's going to be hard to find their way back because it is so crooked.
I also have premeditated, continuing, and escalating.
That's very good because that's exactly what happened with David, isn't it? One thing led to another, then another, and another. It's like when you tell a lie, what do you usually have to do? Yeah, it's kind of hard to stop there, isn't it? You have to tell another one, and then you end up losing track of what's true and what's not, and then you end up convincing yourself. I mean, I think we've probably all been there. It's easy to do. It's easy to do. Okay, sin. What's sin?
Act of violating God's will.
Okay.
Transgression of the law.
I have wrongdoing, disobedience to the divine law, and literally missing the mark. In other words, I guess the law would be the mark, and if we miss it, we sin. We just missed it. Okay, anybody else have something? Okay, let's go to number five.
Evil
on which one? On which? Instead of iniquity?
Only I have sinned and done what is evil in your sight. Mm-hmm. So, I put evil.
Oh, done this evil. That would have been an excellent number four. He used four. You're right.
Well, I chose that because
instead of sin.
You only had three, so that was on the other two too.
Okay, well, how did you describe that then?
Profoundly immoral and malevolent is having or showing a wish to do evil to others. I had to define malevolent.
Malevolent? Is that what you're saying?
Okay, whatever that is.
Okay. Profound, what now?
Profoundly immoral.
Profoundly immoral. Ooh, that's right up there with wickedness, isn't it?
Which all of them did sin against God. It's going against His, you know, His law. And so, and it just seems to me that one just is more involved. You know, sin. Just like
as Elizabeth said, it escalates. It starts with something little, and it turns into, you know, gets bigger and then bigger and then bigger until all of a sudden you've got a problem that you can't even fix. Was there anything David could do to fix this?
No.
No, there was nothing.
He couldn't bring
Uriah back. He couldn't unimpregnate Bathsheba.
He couldn't undo his sin of getting Uriah drunk and trying to cause him to do wrong.
He couldn't undo his losing the child. So it requires mercy because there's sure nothing he can do to fix it. And it's the same with us. When we get ourselves in a situation where we've escalated our sins and piled them up on top of each other, all we can do is ask for forgiveness and beg for mercy. As we're going to talk about later, well, pretty soon here, let's wait to talk about it then. I was going to talk about consequences, but that's down here. Okay, David's willingness to admit his guilt, it's pretty obvious. Several verses. Blot out my transgressions, wash me thoroughly, cleanse me. I acknowledge my sin, transgressions, my sins before me. Only against you have I sinned. I've done this evil in your sight. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. Verse 7. Purge me with hyssop. Make me clean. Wash me. Hide your face from my sins. And again, blot out my iniquities. So, in 2 Samuel 12:13, he said, I have sinned against the Lord. And of course, here it says, against you only and have I sinned. Does that mean that it didn't matter about all these people he hurt? No. He sinned against them as well. But they don't have the power to forgive him or to take away his sin. God is the one who made the law, and it's his law that David has transgressed, and it's his will that David has kicked against and just ignored. Do you think it's possible that he should have thought this beforehand, but I wonder if it's possible that he did not want to suffer Saul's fate, which was basically, in the end, Saul, you know, was separated from God. He lost God's presence. He lost his commendation. He lost his approval, you know, as far as being king. He said, you know, I'm rejecting you as king. You messed up, and it's too bad to even fix. So we're going to move from your family to another family. So, I mean, I just wondered if that could possibly be in David's mind, although, unfortunately, it wasn't in his mind before he did what he did.
The difference in David and Saul is apart. David's mm-hmm. Saul, you know, when he was confronted with his sin, excuse after excuse, same thing people do today, just one excuse after another. David didn't. When his sin was presented to him, he just said, I have sinned. And so his heart was so different.
Right. Even though at the previous point he was trying to cover everything up. He just wasn't awake. You know, he just had his eyes all completely covered up.
Well, unless we get in something, you know, we do something, and then it's normal. It doesn't.
Yes.
And we've got to keep trying to stay ahead of mm-hmm. the ball.
But when he was confronted, he admitted it readily. No hesitation. No backing up. No, oh well, she shouldn't have been on the roof. None of that. He admitted it and went immediately forward to do what he needed to do for forgiveness. So how is this different? Is this usually the reaction of the people we know today?
It's very rare.
It is very rare, unfortunately. And I don't know if that's because our hearts are not right with God, if we don't trust in God and in his will, or we think we know better. I don't know what it is, but people... You know, they've always got a, but this, but that, or you don't understand. My situation's different. I mean, I'm sure we've all heard every excuse there is. If there's more to be made up, I'm sure somebody will come up with it.
The other thing I saw in the story and in this with his talking to God, he didn't blame God.
Nope.
I mean, so many people blame mm-hmm. God.
Why did you let this happen?
Yes, or, you know, why, you know, do it to me. The child died. You know, all these things happened and everything, and the sword was not going to depart from his house. And so, but he recognized the righteous judgment. Even when we see him praying for the life of the child, when the child died, he got up and he washed and he worshiped the Lord. You know,
right.
And so he recognized the righteous judgment, and he wanted to be right again. It wasn't his justification. It wasn't him being glorious in the sight, you know, of people. He wanted God mm-hmm. to be proclaimed
right.
as being the righteous one.
Okay. Who said, look what this woman you made me do. You gave me, made me do.
Yeah, Adam.
The very first man making mm-hmm. excuses. Very, right out of the gate. He didn't have David's heart at all, did he? If I was God, I think I'd have been really scared at that point. Is this what's going to happen with all the people I'm going to create, you know, that are going to come along? Of course, I guess he wouldn't have been because he knows what's going to happen. But that must have been a real slap in the face to God. Any other comments about... is there anything we can do about convincing people not to shift the blame or pointing the finger? How can we help people not do that for ourselves? Do what?
I'm Not doing it ourselves.
And to do that, you know, it's like we've been talking all along. We have to stay on the right path. We have to study. We have to know what God's will is. And we have to devote ourselves to it. We can't do it just on Sundays and Wednesdays. I know that this is... I'm preaching to the choir here. I know we know this. We all know this. Although, sometimes even when we know it, it's easy to get caught up in something.
David knew. Sure he did.
But in a way, that's comforting as well, because the fact that he did know and it happened to him and he had a good heart makes me think there's hope for me to be forgiven. That's, I always think of it that way.
But even when you're as young as these children are here today, they start saying, well, he hit me first.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, everybody else is doing it. They made me do it. You know, that kind of thing. I had three children. They had siblings. I heard it.
Mm-hmm.
But don't learn the way.
I'd like to meet the person who hadn't heard their kid say it. I'd have a hard time believing it.
Or you look at them and you see them do something. I didn't do it.
I just saw them.
Exactly.
It wasn't me.
Not me.
Sometimes I think they're almost convinced. They say it fast enough and long enough.
Yeah.
They didn't do it. But
well, children aren't the only ones that are guilty of that, are they?
No.
We can convince ourselves real easily if we think it hard enough and long enough. Okay, what is required when admitting guilt, not only to ourselves but to others?
An honest heart.
Absolutely, and we've already been talking about David's heart, that he did have an honest heart, which is what made him so favorable to God. If we don't tell the truth, well, we're not going to tell the truth to others if we don't tell it to ourselves. We have to be truthful with ourselves. And like we've been talking, it's very easy to deceive ourselves, to get ourselves in a state where we're convinced that really happened, or that didn't happen, or somebody else did it. Was David truthful with himself up until the point that Nathan came and talked to him?
No. He didn't see himself at all.
Not at all. And I don't know how many times I've said somebody doesn't see themselves as they are. I mean, obviously, we see ourselves, I think, generally, just in general, differently than other people see us, but I think that's why we need one reason we need one another. So if we are, if we do get off the path or miss the mark or something, it's how nice to have somebody point that out to us that loves us and cares about us and wants us to do better. We don't always take it good, do we? We don't always like it when we're corrected, as we already discussed.
Having an honest heart, the second thing I heard the president agree is recognizing that God's law is the rule. You can't find very many people in our society today that says that this is absolute rule, that God's law is right. And if it feels good to you, if you know it in your heart, if you're not hurting anybody else, you know, if you hear all those things, but God's word is truth, and it is the model. And so David recognized that. You know, he knew, when he called it sin, he recognized there is law. And we can justify ourselves because, and especially if we don't know, you know.
Right.
Or if we don't keep it in the forefront of our mind. You know, we could have been good Bible students in the past, but if we stop studying, if we stop praying about it working in our lives, then we could just slip it, you know.
Or if we let life get in the way.
Yes.
If we let our everyday issues and problems come between us and knowing the Word and studying the Word and relying on God for help in those areas, then it makes it even easier.
Mm-hmm.
As we said a while ago, what does a lie lead to?
Another one.
Kind of hard to tell just one. Okay, what are some synonyms for cleansing that he uses?
Purge,
wash, blot out, clean. I have whiter than snow. And here's where we're going to talk about consequences. Can the stains of sin be completely removed? And by that, I mean... consequences or effects, not necessarily on my soul, or you know, if I'm a sinner. Yes, we can have our souls clean, but does that wipe out everything that's happened because of our sin?
No.
Right. Baby can't bring his, these people back to life, the baby, Uriah, and so on. And he probably can't even regain his, the Joab's respect or regard. That's not mentioned here, but, you know, it is mentioned that Joab wasn't happy about this situation.
Well, and then the consequences of the sword not departing from his house. One son, on and on. One son raped a daughter, the brother of the daughter killed, that's the son that raped her, and then Absalom is the one who killed
Absalom's the one that tried to take over the kingdom.
He
killed
Adonijah too. The brother that raped his sister.
Okay.
So, you know, it really messed him up. And can we blame David for what he did? No. But David didn't set the example. So, in some ways, David contributed, I think, to his children's. You know, and the son who raped the daughter. This was after David's. Same with Bathsheba, and it was known. So, okay, you want this, you take it. Dad did. And so, we don't know all that, but that's very possible. That's what happened.
It is possible. I've heard people say that David wasn't a good father, and I really don't think I agree with that. I don't think we know one way or the other what kind of father he was. I think these were consequences that were a result of his sin. God said, the sword will not depart from your house. He, you know, these people are free moral agents. Whatever kind of father David was, these people are adults.
They are, but we are responsible for some of what our children.
Well, in his case, he was king, and he could have prevented maybe.
Well,
some of it.
Whether he was king or not, he was a father, and
yes.
One of his sons is that he never crossed him by asking why you did that.
Absalom, because he loved him.
And so, I think it was Absalom. I think it was another.
Well, he's the one that he said, "My son, my son."
Yeah, he loved him. But I mean, so I'm not so sure he was a good father. You know, for his boys to do some of the things they did, David, as king, he should have killed Absalom when he killed Adonijah.
Well, one thing he could have done was banish the son that raped the sister,
or
the one that killed his brother.
That's what the law said.
That's true.
That he should have been killed. Rape was a capital punishment. There was no second chances.
Okay, you are right. Well, he didn't follow the law. Maybe you're right there. But not only would that be not a good father, that's not a good king, huh? He's human.
Amnon is the one that raped.
Amnon, yes.
Adonijah is the one that tried to take the kingdom. And he's the one that it was said that.
Absalom.
No. Adonijah wanted the kingdom from Solomon. Remember, Solomon had him killed.
After David's death.
After David's death.
Okay, but Absalom tried to take the kingdom from David.
I agree with that, but I'm saying Adonijah is the one that it said that David never crossed him by asking him to
do something.
He wanted the concubine. And as Solomon knew in his wisdom that he was trying to get the kingdom from Solomon, because he immediately had him killed. And if he wasn't up to something, Solomon would not have.
That's a good point. Good point.
And
all right.
He the one that tried to take the kingdom too, and he was anointed before Absalom, because the whole big deal with Absalom Solomon becoming king.
Right.
Was that she even knew that Solomon and her were both be dead if that happened?
Okay.
Not
what? That's okay. What's David asking for in verses 10-12?
A clean heart and a steadfast spirit. The steadfast spirit, you know, don't let me get off track, you know, help me not to get off track again, you know.
And why? Why would he want that? Why would he not want to be off track? He wanted to be in the presence of God. Ephesians 2, we're all familiar with verses 1-9, that how God grants us forgiveness through his grace. And that's just the same situation. He knows that God can forgive him, that he will make his soul clean and pure. And he literally asked God to hide his face from his sins. Mm-hmm. So he's feeling pretty low.
Yeah, he wanted the joy again of salvation.
Right.
And that's what some people, when they say, "I know I'm forgiven," but they just still wallow in there. You know, you can either be a Peter or you can be a Judas. You can get up after you've sinned and work and serve God, or you can be a Judas and go out and hang yourself.
And David did like Peter. He got up and got back to work.
That's it.
And same with Paul. You know, when Paul was converted, he immediately left what he was doing behind and immediately went the other direction. And what is the sacrifice that God desires above all else? Right. He's not as near as interested in sacrifice as that. It's the heart he's interested in. This is the kind of sacrifice he wants, is a broken heart and contrite spirit, rather than blood sacrifices, which, you know, it's been the case since all the way back to King Saul. When he disobeyed God and just took things in his own hands, God says, you know, I want sacrifices. That may be what the law says, or what you think I expect. But you've got to do it with a clean heart. It's not, it just cancels it out if your heart isn't where it ought to be.
Have something wrote.
Wrote. Yeah, that's good.
That's the thing to do. We do it because we believe God and it's His will.
Okay. All right, and then the very last question. Because He wants, like Pat mentioned a while ago, He wants the joy of salvation again. And so He wants to be upheld by His Spirit so He can do what? What does He want to share with others? God's righteousness. I have that. Anything else? What about others? What does He want to teach others about?
He wants to teach them God's way.
Right.
And what is right? The word of salvation.
Right. And learn from my mistakes. I did this wrong, but this is, you know, I completely went against God's ways. I went against His word, and this is wrong. But, you know, don't do it this way. Can people who are self-righteous help people who are broken? Can people who are self-righteous help anybody? They're pretty much got it set, and they're probably thinking everybody else needs to get their act together and you know, get on with the program. Those with a broken spirit are the ones that can help those who are broken. Those who need lifting up or encouragement or just help getting through something, whether it's a personal situation or a problem with one of your family members or something like that. If we don't share our experiences with one another, you know, we're all just sitting at home in our own little box, and we can't help each other grow. We can't help each other get past this stuff. We can't be an encouragement to one another by letting somebody know, yeah, that happened to me too, and this is how I worked through it, or this is how I got past it. Because if we hide all this stuff and keep it inside us, then we can't help anybody. Or if we come to the point where we think we're better than others because we got past it, or because we never did it, then we sure can't help anybody. What do you want to say?
They fall into deep depression. I find it interesting, verse 14, after you already talked about all the sin and all that kind of stuff, you know, back earlier, deliver me from blood guiltiness. Can you imagine the guilt of shed blood and the baby? You know, he has this on his heart, but he doesn't go in and turn his face against the wall and not eat it, you know.
Okay, yeah. Help.
He asked God, help me deal with this guilt. And, you know, yes, you get forgiveness, but God is the answer, and His salvation and His love and His mercy will help us deal with the consequences of this life that we have messed up, you know, and caused. And so he's asking God, you know, I have done wrong, wrongfully murdered everything from Uriah, you know, and the baby dying, and then everything that God told him was going to be happening, you know. It's on his heart. How does he deal with it? Approach to God. Like you said, it's busier than God. And he tells others, look at me, I messed up. Let's do that.
Mr. Boone, any other comments on the lesson? Okay, I want y'all to know how much I appreciate you doing the lessons and coming and talking. It makes for a lot better class. And I know that I probably did not cover this entire psalm the way somebody else might have. But the main thing to me was to get out of it the fact that David's heart was what it ought to be, and that David, it was a human person like we are. And he messed up really bad. And we all know we mess up, but this is proof that there is hope for those who mess up, those who sin so badly that, man, they really, I mean, really badly.